Welcome, everyone, to the Arc of Wrestling. Steve, it's been a fucking whirlwind of a morning.
It's a glass case of emotions? Is that like it?
Yeah, I don't know if whirlwind was the correct word. It's been a frustrating morning, ladies and gentlemen. It took us damn near an hour just to get this podcast started because technology sucks.
You know what doesn't suck?
What's that?
Goldberg.
Jumping right into things there, aren't we?
You asked me what doesn't suck, and Goldberg doesn't suck, right? We all like Goldberg. He's
booking of
he's
Goldberg
gonna be,
sucks.
He's going to Hall of Fame here in here That's a couple
true.
Months.
That is true.
I think isn't it April 3rd?
Yeah, I don't know when WrestleMania is.
April 8th. Right, we'll find out pretty soon. They'll have don't they already have the countdown going? They got the WrestleMania signs at the events. Everybody's pointing. It's pointing season, Jeremy. Time
it
to point.
Is pointing season.
We should do a podcast about the point one of these days. Just like, you know, the greatest points of all time.
Ronda Rousey would top be of the list very low on that list.
Lashley did pretty well. Bobby Lashley did good point, so maybe we'll see him pretty soon.
For those that don't know, I'm Jeremy Lambert. I'm joined by Steve Cook. And this is the Arc of Wrestling on thechairshot.com.
Bam.
We are here to talk about Goldberg, in case you didn't pick up on that in this first minute.
My great segue. That is one of the best segues of all time. Bill Goldberg was a man who used to be a professional wrestler. Before that, he played professional football for the Atlanta Falcons, and I believe, I want to say he was on the Carolina Panthers for a brief period of time, was he not?
I don't think so. I don't remember Goldberg on the Panthers.
I thought I saw Goldberg wearing a Carolina uniform. I believe he holds the record for tackles still in Carolina history.
What?
I may have just made that up.
It does say he played on the Panthers See? Practice squad in 1995.
That's right, the practice squad.
All right, sure.
Told you.
Practice squad doesn't count.
He's your boy.
I guess Brock Lesnar is officially an NFL player too, then.
He's your boy.
I have no issues with Goldberg. We're here to talk about Goldust putting a wig on him.
No, that's a different arc entirely.
That is a different arc entirely. We're here to talk about the streak. We're going to pipe in Goldberg chants all throughout this podcast.
We're streaking.
I'm thinking of just putting Goldberg chants behind this entire podcast. So in
That'd
the background,
cool.
everyone will
I
just
like
hear
it.
The chants.
Yeah, we're live on the scene in the Georgia Dome where all you heard was Goldberg chants, man, because, dude, that guy, when he first came in, are we diving in? What are we doing?
Well, let's get started. Goldberg made his debut on September 22nd, Nitro, in Salt Lake City, Utah. He defeated Humorous.
Yes.
To go 1-0.
Later known as Bill DeMott, later known as General Rection. Later known as Huge Erection, which is another wonderful story which we'll be covering in a later podcast, I'm sure.
Later known
Misfits in Action, no?
Later known as the guy who beat up trainees.
Yeah, that guy. That guy. He was a wonderful human being. But in this particular instance, Humorous was a guy, he was kind of a mid-card kind of guy. Had some bit of credibility. He's a big guy. Did moonsault.
He was in the Dungeon of Doom.
That's right. Hanging out the Barbarian and Ming and Kevin Sullivan and the Shark. All those guys. The Yeti was hanging out with him. So he had a good bit of credibility. So it was a little bit surprising when this Greenhorn, this guy we'd never seen before, comes in and just beats Humorous right off the bat. You kind of knew right away that this guy was a somebody. And then right after the match, Mean Gene tries to get a word from Bill Goldberg, and you get nothing. Nothing from Bill Goldberg for Mean Gene.
Goldberg went on to beat a bunch of people. We're going to skip through the early part of his career.
He beat a bunch of people. The one thing that bugged me about the whole Goldberg not talking to Mean Gene and all that, and Mike Tenay had no information on Bill Goldberg like before the match. Like, he knew nothing about the guy.
Tony, I certainly pride myself on knowing the background, the experience factor of the wrestlers involved, and I don't have any information on Bill Goldberg. Help me out, Larry.
You don't know.
We have stumped Tanay.
Fire him.
It's a first.
Which didn't make a lot of sense because, as we said, the guy was a former football player and he'd been training at the power plant. So why wouldn't Mike Tanay know about this guy?
Because he's over 205 pounds.
All right, that makes sense.
Goldberg's earliest feud, his biggest feud early on, was against Mongo McMichael. They paired up the two football players, and they feuded over Mongo's Super Bowl ring. That's all I remember.
The 85 Bears, man. Goldberg was pissed off they got cut from the Super Bowl shuffle team, is what happened there.
They had no information about Goldberg, but they figured out that he played football at some point.
Yeah. They figure out he played football, and they're pretty excited. Tony Schiavone was excited because he's a Georgia Bulldogs guy. You would think, actually, Tony Schiavone being a Georgia Bulldogs guy, he would have recognized Bill Goldberg, right?
You would think, but he did not.
For a WCW, Tony Schiavone was not the most intelligent man.
No. I remember Goldberg beating Glacier, like a year after Glacier debuted. And it's just... The bloom was off the rose, the Glacier rose by that point. It was off way before, but it just went to show how far Glacier had fallen, that he was losing to this guy who'd been in the business for 2 months.
A cup of coffee, pretty much. The thing is, and we've seen people start these streaks up over and over again. We remember Ryback getting the streak treatments and people were chanting Goldberg. The reason that doesn't work now is because with the lack of jobber matches in general, you just don't see them anymore. WCW wasn't feeding Goldberg these unnamed guys because they had this whole roster full of anybody that ever wrestled in life, pretty much Jerry Flynn and Glacier and Chris Adams and Steven Regal. They just had an endless amount of guys they could feed Goldberg.
They did have a roster full of guys, which is part of the problem.
As part of the, it worked for this though. It worked because Goldberg was beating guys you'd heard of.
Yeah.
You'd at least seen these guys before. Even if they didn't have the greatest win-loss records, they at least won matches at some point in life. It wasn't Billy Bob from down the street popping up to do a job,
Right. He was beating big guys. He was beating small guys. It was an impressive streak, and he ran his number all the way up to 74 when he faced Saturn at 73 at this point when he faced Saturn at Spring Stampede in 1998 and he beat Saturn.
Yeah.
And the next night on Nitro, he got a United States title shot against Raven. Raven had won the US title from Diamond Dallas Page the night before. What a great feud that was.
That was a good feud.
This match took place at the top of the hour, the first hour of Nitro, but it got the Michael Buffer treatment. So you knew right then and there that they knew they had something with Goldberg. They gave this guy the Michael Buffer treatment in the first hour of the show.
When you get the Buffer, you're doing pretty well. That's true.
Right. And Buffer announces that Goldberg's hometown is unknown, even though I'm pretty sure it was established he's from Atlanta by this point. Or at least Georgia.
I want to say they're still introducing him from parts unknown after this, which makes no sense. Unless you're the Ultimate Warrior, you probably shouldn't be from parts unknown.
Yeah.
If you're like Bill Goldberg, guy from down, you shouldn't be from parts unknown. That makes sense.
Raven comes out without the flock, but they're all sitting ringside, so they're there. It's Raven's rules. But when Goldberg puts him in a heel hook, Raven gets the ropes. So rope breaks are allowed in Raven's rules.
Well, that's a great thing about Raven's rules is that when Raven's making the rules, he can kind of make things up on the fly. You see, that's smart by Raven.
Goldberg hits the concussion kick, and it's marked as the first time that he ever hit this kick. Bret Hart wishes he never hit this kick.
Yeah, he didn't hit as well on Raven as he did on Bret. Let's say that.
Goldberg ends up hitting the spear. The flock comes in. Goldberg tosses them all, including the big man, Reese.
Big Reese got jackhammered, for God's sakes. Ridiculous.
And Raven tries to leave through the crowd, but the fans, legitimate fans, I'm
That's
sure.
That's great.
They pick him up, and they toss him back into ringside. Goldberg hits the spear, jackhammer on the stop sign. 75-0.
Everyone standing as Goldberg is going
United States champion.
Yeah, that is a good moment right there. And Raven was the guy who'd just been through a feud with Diamond Dallas Page. He'd been booked pretty well ever since coming into ICW. He had those flat guys around him hanging around doing their thing. So beating Raven was a pretty big deal. Believe it or not, I know it's tough to say. It's a weird thing to say now, isn't it? Right? Because let's face it, everybody's beating Raven by now. But back then, 1998, beating Raven was a big deal.
Yeah, WCW definitely pushed Raven. That whole Stevie Richards thing kind of went nowhere, but I think that had to do with Richards jumping between WWF and ECW and WCW at that point.
That'd be kind of ironic when Raven eventually left ICW for feeling that he was mistreated and mishandled and all that stuff. When, boy, after that.
He really wasn't a star. I remember the whole Saturn angle was really good with the Flock. The Flock was an underrated story in WCW at that time. But yeah, Goldberg beat him, and again, they knew they had something with this guy.
Yeah.
Goldberg
went on to wrestle Mike Enos.
Yeah, he went on to wrestle Mike Enos. He did defend the U.S. title against Conan and Kurt Hennig and other NWO guys, and then built up his record. So the July 2nd edition of Thunder, J.J. Dillon comes out and he says, you know, sometimes I love my job, sometimes I have bad parts of my job, and tonight is one of those nights where I love my job, because Hollywood Hogan is contractually obligated to defend his title, and he's going to defend his title in the Georgia Dome, which is Goldberg's unknown hometown.
Yes.
Against Goldberg.
Yeah.
And the crowd goes crazy for this.
That they did.
And so we head to... So the backstory behind this is the match was initially supposed to be a dark match, and Hogan wasn't going to put the title on the line. And then they saw how big the audience was, the attendance was. And then Hogan decided, all right, well, I'm going to main event this show and get credit for drawing this big old crowd here.
Classic Hogan.
He knew that the crowd was going to be big, so he said, advertise it as a dark match. And so that way he would get credit regardless. But then he saw that it was even bigger upon release of tickets and everything. And so then he was like, all right, well, we got to do this on TV. And he was basically talked into doing the match. And we'll get into the backstory and the theatrics behind Hollywood Hogan after we review the match and everything. But we go to July 6th, Nitro, Georgia Dome. It was astounding to see this giant-ass arena packed for Nitro.
Yeah, it looked like a WrestleMania crowd.
It was a huge crowd. And I know WWF ran the same building months later, and they drew a big crowd as well. Like, just seeing these stadiums packed for, you know, a television show. So the setup is the same as it is for, you know, WrestleMania. They obviously do the big entrance and everything and all the over-the-top stuff. But this is your normal Nitro setup as it would be at, you know, a 20,000 seat arena in a 60,000 seat arena, which is just nuts. So Georgia Dome, Nitro, the attendance was 41,412, which was a sellout for that configuration. And apparently a few hundred fans were turned away, and they ended up doing a gate of 900,000. That's a lot of money.
That is a lot of money. And they always say, you know, they always make sure point out whenever they talk about this on their various documentaries. Can you imagine how many they would have drawn if they had announced it before Thursday?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they drew a sellout, so it's tough to, I don't know. I can't fault them. We'll talk about.
I'm just throwing a WWE party line out there. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. We'll get into more about it. Let's review this show, because it was built around Hogan and Goldberg, and Hogan kicks off the show and he says, I'm not wrestling Goldberg tonight. He says Goldberg instead, he's going to face a mystery NWO brother that hasn't been around for a while. And then he says, but if Goldberg beats him, then I'll wrestle.
Yeah.
All right. Are you wrestling him or not, dude? It should be noted, this is the go-home show for Bash at the Beach.
Oh, yeah, where Hogan was teaming with Rodman, with Dennis Rodman against DDP and Karl Malone.
That's right.
So we saw a little bit of those
guys.
What
a get that was for WCW at the time.
Rodman and Malone were a big deal, I'm telling you. I mean, that was right off the NBA Finals, too.
Yeah, exactly. It was a month, not even a month, after the NBA Finals where they had faced each other for a second straight year. WCW did a lot of things wrong. The fact that they pulled this off is pretty amazing.
And they actually got them to wrestle, too. It wasn't like Rob Gronkowski hanging out in the crowd and throwing a push at Jinder Mahal.
Imagine WWF getting Draymond Green and Kevin Love, because I mean, Rodman's not LeBron's not Rodman, so you got to go down the pecking order. But I guess LeBron could be Malone and Rodman could be Draymond, so okay, imagine, there you go. WWF getting LeBron and Draymond a month after the finals to wrestle each other.
Yeah, SummerSlam or something like that. Yeah. Big money.
It's amazing that WCW was able to get these two. So anyway, Scott Hall is the mystery NWO white that comes out to face Goldberg. And Hall gets a one count on the old Shawn Michaels back suplex. And Schiavone says that's as close as anyone has ever gotten to beating Goldberg, which is probably true, but a one count, which just goes to show how much this man has been protected during this streak. NWO members start to come out, and here comes Malone and Page, and they hit him with chairs. And apparently the story is that DDP hit the Disciple so hard with the chair that he split him open in the back of his head, which almost led to a fight backstage between them. Hall goes for the outsider's edge, but Goldberg backdrops him out. Spear, jackhammer, we have our main event.
Yeah. Well, there's a little something to whet the appetite of the audience. I thought, you know, Hogan trying to hide behind the NWO guys, bring out Scott Hall. It made perfect sense to me. I thought it was a good way to whet the appetite, get people raised for later in the night. You had DDP and Malone out there holding off the NWO. They didn't like interfere or anything. They were just holding off all the guys that are trying to interfere. Not that those guys were very useful anyway.
If you're going to build a show around Goldberg, build a show around Goldberg. I was fine with him just beating Scott Hall and then setting up the match with Hogan. Like, it honestly made sense. Hogan and Goldberg in the main event. Loud Goldberg chant. And when you hear it live, you realize how every other chant is piped in throughout this show and throughout Goldberg's run. Because it is not perfect. Some people are chanting the gold while the other people are chanting the Berg parts. And, you know, it's a crowd chant.
It's tough to get 41,000 people on the same page.
It is very true. So Hogan does his usual stalling and stuff. They go outside. Hogan hits him with some weak chair shots. So weak that even Steve Austin and Pat Patterson were like, wow, those are some weak chair shots. Hogan hits a
one that week.
Hogan hits a scoop slam and he hits two leg drops, which the announcers even really talk about.
They just
dismissed these leg drops.
Well, and it's in the middle of the part of the finish, which was didn't really hit home for me, where you're about to mention you have Kurt Hennig walking out there. For no real reason. It doesn't seem like there's any real reason for Kurt Hennig walk out there. He's just like doing the thumbs up and all that, right in the middle of Hulk Hogan dropping the big legs. And then out of nowhere, Karl Malone hits a diamond cutter out of nowhere, because it's always out of nowhere.
Hogan hits two leg drops and they cut to Kurt Hennig walking down the aisle. And then you just hear the mat move for a third time. So you just assume he hits a third leg drop, but Kevin Dunn missed it.
Yeah. I mean, kicking out three leg drops is like a pretty big deal.
Yeah, he covers and then Goldberg kicks out and then Hogan is just distracted by Hennig and then Malone hits diamond cutter. And when Hogan turns around, spear, jackhammer, that's it. Hulk Hogan defeated by the man.
Look at Goldberg. He's ready. His boys are going down. push him off. He's calling for it. This is it. This is it. Your career's on the line here. Do it. Do it. His place will erupt when he picks him up. He's got him up.
Yeah, the new man, the new champion.
The crowd.
Bill Goldberg. Talk about putting a guy over.
The pop for this is insane. People throw trash in the ring for some reason.
They always did that in this era.
They did. Always threw. I don't get it. So more backstory to this match. Raw was starting to win the ratings war. They'd won 8 out of the last 10 weeks, and the other 2 weeks were ties. I think they'd won something like 4 or 5 straight. So WCW, even though they had a pay-per-view on Sunday, just decided to give this match away for free with less than a week build.
As always, Eric Bischoff's main thing was the ratings. He was fixated on that.
It worked. I mean, Nitro drew a 4.9, Raw drew a 4. It turned out that the title change was the most watched quarter hour in wrestling history. Which it had about 7 million total viewers. It was in about 5 million homes. So, yeah, it worked. It didn't work for long because Raw won the ratings war the next week.
Well, that is right in the middle of the Austin McMahon stuff, too. So they were firing on all cylinders at that point.
Yeah. And then Bash at the Beach. What did Goldberg do at Bash at the Beach? He just beat Kurt Hennig in 3 minutes.
He beat Kurt Hennig in 3 minutes. It was a title match. They changed it to a title match. Kurt Hennig, he got to walk out there and get diamond cutter by Carl Malone and got a title match out of it. So I guess that worked for him.
And Hogan and Malone. I think Bash at the Beach ended up being the second biggest WCW pay-per-view of all time, with Malone and Rodman headlining alongside Paige and Hogan. So yeah, Hogan was still the star, even though we put Goldberg over.
And to me, and looking back, hindsight be 2020, it seems like one of the main purposes of putting the belt on Goldberg at that point was that way Hogan wouldn't be the champion when he's out there, you know, messing around Karl Malone, and then the next month messing around the talk show host.
Sure, the real purpose was he wanted credit for drawing the Georgia Dome crowd, and he was told that you put Goldberg over now and you'll be the guy to end the streak.
Yeah.
And so that was the real reason Hogan won.
Yeah, brother.
I mean, he was still going to be the star of the show. It was very, very much like Chris Benoit's title reign or Daniel Bryan's title reign, where they were the champion, but they weren't the focal point of the show.
Right. They're just kind of hanging out in the middle card defending against guys like Kurt Hennig, while the main eventers like the Hogans, or in Benoit's case, Triple H and Shawn Michaels, guys like that, they were the real stars.
Yeah. So, again, Bash at the Beach, Goldberg beats hitting. What does Goldberg do after this? He cuts his first promo on the August 3rd edition of Nitro. Ooh. Comes out with Mean Gene, and he basically says, "I'm entering the NWO Battle Royal at Road Wild."
Not quite the same ring to it as the Royal Rumble.
No. And he does the whole "you're next" thing, and yeah. This promo was fine. It's just, this is what you're doing with your world champion. You're putting him in this fucking battle royal just to face the Giant. He says, I just want to get my hands on the Giant.
Yeah, okay. I mean, well, he got to do that while in the main event at Road Wild was Hulk Hogan. Eric Bischoff against DDP and Jay Leno, of all people.
Yeah. The attendance for Road Wild, they drew $0 because this was Bischoff's brilliant biker idea. Stupid gimmick this was.
You know, it was stupid, but at the same time, as a fan just watching that didn't give a crap about, you know, gates and things like that and making money, I thought it was fun to see in a different environment.
WCW did do a lot of fun environment stuff like this. And obviously the Panama, you know, Nitro Spring Break was always really fun.
Yeah, and people go in the pool.
I mean, shit, the first ever Nitro was in a mall.
Yeah.
They held the bash at the beach, on the beach, which was cool. I'd like to see more of that.
I like that. They thought it's out of the box sometimes. And so the whole Sturgis thing didn't bother me so much. You know, some people complain that they didn't react well to certain matches, but whatever.
People matches.
they didn't like black people matches. They didn't like Benoit or Malenko and those guys. Yeah.
They
like the stars. What do you expect?
I remember watching these shows, and I've actually rewatched some of them as I go through a binge, and I didn't think Booker T and Stevie Ray were going to make it out alive on one of these shows. Oh, yeah. Road Wild. We get the NWO Battle Royal. The NWO is split at this point with Hollywood and Wolfpack. And a lot of stars in this match. Hall, Nash, Luger, Sting, Giant, and then Conan and Hit Inc. as well. Goldberg is the lone wolf in this match. Still being introduced from parts unknown, even though he won the title in the Georgia Dome. He eliminates Hall off the outsider's edge. He backdrops him out of the ring. Kevin Nash starts to go over the top rope, and Goldberg pump fakes him and scowls, and Nash just eliminates himself. So I'm sure Goldberg got credit for that elimination as well. He eliminates Conan and Hitting after spears. Sting and Norton are battling on the ropes. Goldberg tosses them. He spears Luger, and Giant ends up tossing Luger, but Goldberg gets credit for that elimination. Giant ends up chokeslamming Goldberg, but Goldberg does the Taker sit-up there. And spear, jackhammer, he pins him, because I guess you pin the last man. Goldberg wins this battle royal, and I'm pretty sure they counted this as 8 wins for Goldberg.
Well, why not? It's good to see that Goldberg, he achieved his goal of getting his hands on the Giant.
He did show up at the end of the pay-per-view after Leno and Page had won. They got beat down by the NWO, and Goldberg came out and ran them off. This was all to get Goldberg in the mainstream press shots with next to Jay Leno, which was a smart move, actually.
Sure. I mean, the Leno thing didn't work as well as the Malone and Rodman stuff. Not because, for one thing, Malone and Rodman are actually athletes, and you could buy them, you know, in a wrestling ring. You can believe that. Jay Leno, no, you can't believe that.
I think it was just too soon. Like, you can't do it, like, back-to-back like that.
I mean, the most athletic thing Jay Leno ever done was a chin-up.
I don't think you can do it back-to-back, and I don't think you can downgrade either. Like, Malone and Rodman to Leno, like, that's a downward move.
It is.
They're drawing just his WCW's audience at this time, you know, is kind of the high school, college, you know, teenage to 30s crowd, I believe. And Leno is an old dude that
he was never appealing to that crowd.
Yeah.
Well, people watched him, but not that crowd.
Yeah, exactly. So I just don't think it was it was a downgrade, wrong move, too soon. But Goldberg was there with the shots with Leno. We got some mainstream publicity out of it, and they capitalized it by doing nothing with him.
Doing nothing, yes.
He was kind of the third man involved in a Hogan and Nash power struggle over the NWO. He didn't do anything. They'd set up war games for whoever wins war games would get a shot at Goldberg's title at Halloween Havoc.
That was the convoluted war games too.
Oh my God.
That thing's a mess.
That was the last war games ever, wasn't it? Until WWE brought it back?
No, Russo did one on Nitro too, and that was also a complete mess.
Well, the last war games at Fall Brawl then.
Yes.
Goldberg just basically did a bunch of nothing, and at this time Chris Jericho started his own feud. He went off script. He started calling out Goldberg, and you know, he beat him by count out, and then at Fall Brawl he got a fake Goldberg to come out, not Gilbert, just a fake Goldberg, and he beat him.
Goldberg.
He beat him, so he was 2-0 against Goldberg. Goldberg did not appear on the Fall Brawl pay-per-view.
What, he had something else to do?
I remember the crowd being pissed off when Jericho beats the fake Goldberg and the real Goldberg just doesn't show up.
Right, that's when you expect the real Goldberg to come out and spear Jericho out of his boots.
Yeah. The next night on Nitro after Fall Brawl. So Paige wins the War Games. Quick story about this. This was a couple days before my birthday, and I had just moved to North Carolina at this point. But I had some friends, made some friends at the apartment complex that we had lived in, and they were wrestling fans as well. So I had them over for my birthday, and you know, we're all representing. I was a big Sting guy at this point.
Sure.
My other friend was a Goldberg fan. And then I did have a DDP shirt, believe it or not. And so my other friend wore this DDP shirt. And so we were really excited about this pay-per-view. And we watched War Games. I was so dejected watching this match. I'm 10 years old, mind you. And even I understood that this was just the biggest bullshit match I'd ever seen in my life. And I'm a fan who likes dumb matches. Like I love the World War III concept. I love the fucking Doomsday Cage match.
You mean Warrior popping out of the door didn't do anything for you?
No. I was like, what is this nonsense? And DDP wins, and I remember feeling like so sad that of all people, Diamond Dallas Page won. And I didn't have anything against Diamond Dallas Page. I was just like, this is the guy who wins. And so my friend who had the DDP shirt on, we beat him up afterwards. Not actually beat him up, but you know, we hit some wrestling moves on him. Even though you're not supposed to try that stuff at home, we did.
Did you walk around like Hulk Hogan, Stevie Ray, and hit people with a stock for like 10 minutes?
I was just so disappointed in this match. 10-year-old me was on the verge of tears when I guess I was technically 9 at this point because it wasn't quite my birthday. That's all I remember about this match is just being very disappointed with how it ended and how just stupid it was.
I gotta tell you though, and I'll disagree a little bit because there's a lot of stuff about DDP that people said later on. But Ric Flair pretty much buried him in his book, and you talk about how it's a bit of a letdown that DDP won that match. But you got to keep in mind, this is a guy who was just seen tag teaming with Karl Malone and tag teaming with Jay Leno. So DDP was incredibly hot at this point. He was also calling himself the People's Champion, like The Rock. And I remember Tony Schiavone going on a rant. I think it was on the Halloween Havoc about the whole
show,
about the People's Champion business. And DDP had a real connection to the crowd at that point. And I had no problem with Paige going on to Halloween Havoc to take on Goldberg. And it turned out that the match was pretty good too. I mean, especially by Goldberg standards.
It was. Looking back, I can appreciate DDP winning, but 9-year-old me just wasn't having it. Didn't want Diamond Dallas Page to win that match.
You would rather had the Ultimate Warrior win, and and there's the same show, by the way, it's Halloween Havoc, which one of the great matches of all time, the Ultimate Rematch. Oh, what a match that was.
The next night on Nitro, I remember missing this match, and I was very disappointed that I missed it, because this was one day before my birthday, and again, I was a huge Sting fan. Sting was probably my favorite wrestler. And I taped it. I had to tape this. I think I recorded over like my mom's wedding anniversary or something. Like I recorded over so much like home videos with wrestling stuff that made my mom mad. So I had to tape this match. Because I could not miss Goldberg against Sting. And this was the famous Ric Flair Returns episode as well. This was a huge episode of Nitro. Ric Flair really comes back, Goldberg and Sting in the main event. So we get Goldberg and Sting. Sting hits a couple of Stinger splashes, and Goldberg goes for a spear, misses. He posts himself. Sting applies a scorpion, but doesn't really get the leverage on it. Goldberg just kind of lays there flat on the mat.
Yeah.
Didn't look very pretty. And Hulk Hogan comes in.
Oh, this running.
It kicks Sting in the back of the head.
Sting sold like a gunshot, too.
And the referee who's checking on Goldberg just doesn't notice, even though Hogan is literally standing right over him.
He got out of the ring and then he started hiding. So he tried.
When he kicks Sting, he's literally standing right next to the referee. And Sting just falls?
Pretty much. Like, he just looks like.
This was so stupid.
I guess the referee thought Sting had brain aneurysm or something.
I don't know. Goldberg ends up getting up, spear, jackhammer. Hogan beats up Goldberg after the match with some weak looking offense that Goldberg has to sell. But this was actually a good match, and I remember watching it and being a little disappointed Sting won, but I liked Goldberg as well.
It was the first time I could recall during Goldberg's career that there's a bit of a mixed reaction there, where Sting had a lot of the fans behind him. Sting was the franchise player at ICW for all those years. And no matter what they did, people were still behind the guy.
Wolfpack Sting was so weird.
It was.
He went from silent assassin crow Sting to
happy.
Yeah.
He's happy now.
Eccentric red and black Sting. It was very strange. But yeah, Sting was still over, and Goldberg was obviously over. The build up for Goldberg and DDP was them staring at each other a lot. They didn't actually do anything. Chris Jericho was still working his own angle. He was trying to get a match with Goldberg, and Goldberg just said no. He saw Jericho as just being too small. He was a cruiserweight guy, and Jericho, not only that, but Jericho wanted to work a different match. He didn't want to just go out there and be squashed in 2 minutes. So like that.
And to be fair, Goldberg, he was very, very green in business at that point, and he basically bought what people told him.
Yeah.
And people told him that Chris Jericho wasn't on his level.
It was true, though. I mean,
it was true, sure. But sometimes you have to have those little off-brand programs like that. It keeps the fans interested.
Jericho should have been willing to take the squash.
Oh,
I guess if you're Chris Jericho, you want to protect yourself and not just get beat in 2 minutes by the guy. But
well, yeah, at the same time, Jericho's character was such that he should have been getting beat in 2 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like, especially when you've completely buried this guy and you're claiming to be 2-0 and everything, like you should just get beat in 2 minutes.
That's the finish. That's the finish of the angle. And I guess, but if you're Jericho, you're wondering like what happens to me after that. But as far as Jericho was kind of bulletproof with a lot of people at that point. I was a big big Jericho fan. They're the Jericho-holics and all that stuff in ICW, and it was soon after that they pretty much checked out. And
yeah, the go home edition of Nitro before Havoc, Jericho wrestled DDP for the television title. Jericho was a TV champ at this point. Goldberg came out and speared Jericho, so that caused
there's the
DQ.
Big interaction. Yes.
and then Goldberg and Paige stared at each other some more, and Paige ends up hitting the diamond cutter on Jericho, so Jericho gets squashed in this instance anyway.
Okay.
Oh yeah, your build up for Goldberg and DDP was them looking at each other a lot.
They would copy that formula later on for many feuds.
Halloween Havoc, October 25th, 1998. You either watched it on pay-per-view or you watched it the next night on Nitro.
Yes.
We will talk about that after we review this match. So Goldberg and Diamond Dallas Page in the main event. This was probably the best Goldberg WCW match he had during his run.
I'd say so, yes. I would have to agree.
Paige, I read that they spent, you know, weeks at the WCW power plant. Paige was notorious for just scripting out all of his matches.
Yeah.
And a lot of people didn't like that. But for Goldberg, it definitely worked. So they spent weeks working on this match, and it showed because they were in position. They did everything right. Paige didn't. He got into a power game early with Goldberg. That didn't work out too well. So he used his brain against the rookie. Still, I guess he'd been a year in the business at this point, but not compared to the years Paige had racked up. Moved on a spear, and Goldberg posts himself. That seems to be the best move against this guy. Goldberg Goldberg ends up hitting a spear, but he had hurt his shoulder, so he sold the shoulder. Paige hit a diamond cutter, but it was a long delay. He'd taken so much damage that he couldn't pin him. And unlike Triple H and Booker T, Goldberg was able to kick out after the diamond cutter. And then Paige picked up Goldberg, and he went for a suplex, but Goldberg blocked it, and he turned it into a jackhammer, pinned him. Crowd was a little split on this match. They were pretty,
sure.
They were behind DDP. Yeah, and Goldberg ends up winning to keep the title. Again, good match, especially by Goldberg standards.
Yeah, and you mentioned how DDP is notorious for planning things out, and there's definitely some mixed feelings on that. That's why Flair was so dismissive of him, but I mean, DDP is one of those guys, and another one of those guys was Macho Man Randy Savage. I mean, Savage is also known for scripting all his matches out to a T, and certainly it worked when those two guys wrestled each other. They had some fantastic matches because they both believed in that. And Goldberg was a guy that could take direction, and hence, good stuff, good times. I don't know why y'all hating on it's DDP.
I like DDP. I did DDP yoga for a while.
Did it work?
I gave up on it too soon.
Okay.
I enjoyed it. Like, it's good. It's fine.
People recommend that to me for years, and I'm not very flexible.
Yeah, neither am I. I mean, I have no problem. 9-year-old me, 10-year-old me, not the biggest Diamond Dallas Page fan in the world, but nearly 30-year-old me can appreciate his work. And yeah, I didn't have a problem with... Or I don't have a problem with him scripting out matches, especially against a guy like Goldberg. Like, you should probably script these matches out. There's a reason why this ended up being the best Goldberg match during his run.
Yeah, and, you know, and to throw it back to another match on that card, the first Hulk Hogan Ultimate Warrior match was scripted out, and the second one, well, I don't know.
I don't know what they did for a second one.
I think this got high before a second one, as far as I could tell.
We should do an arc on Hogan and Warrior.
Yes, we should. Oh, that was a classic. I was rewatching that again for some reason. Oh, just a classic match. In every sense of the word, just classic.
So you either saw this match on pay-per-view or you saw it the next night on Nitro, because the show ran long. It went 3 hours and 15 minutes, but most cable companies had only allotted them 2 hours or 3 hours for the pay-per-view. So if you had a dish, I believe, it cut out. Or if you had a satellite, actually, or cable. Blech. If you had cable, it cut out on you. Did this pay-per-view cut out on you, Steve Cook, or did you were able to finish
it? I seem to remember that it did not cut out for me, which is weird because I had cable. But I also had a black box, so
yeah,
I don't know if that had anything to do with it or not, but
I had cable.
I remember seeing the match.
I had cable as well, and I don't recall it cutting out either. Maybe it did, and I just can't remember, but I don't recall it cutting out.
I remember seeing the end of it, so it must have. I mean, if it did cut out, it came back, at least for me. But
yeah.
Then you can watch it again next night on Nitro. Yeah.
Next night on Nitro, Tony Schiavone, he apologizes, but he doesn't blame WCW for this. He basically just blames the cable companies. And he
shades of Donald Trump.
And he says, we're going to give away the Goldberg and DDP match right here. Fans also missed the finish of Hogan and Warrior. And Schiavone says that finish was too controversial to show on television.
That's a code word for Horace Hogan came in and hit Warrior with a weak-ass chair shot, and we just don't want to show it again because it's so bad.
Yeah. So they give away Goldberg and Page on Nitro, and I remember cable companies being, I don't remember, I read about it, but cable companies were upset at this because it killed the replay business the next day on Tuesday. They gave this away, and Page and Goldberg actually broke the all-time cable television viewing record with a 7.1 rating.
That happened a lot during this time period.
5.3 million homes and about 7.7 million viewers. So the biggest ratings match of all time, Goldberg and DDP.
Good times. Good times for – and, you know, it's funny because later on, I remember this. That's another thing that WWE would crap on the ACW over and over again in all these various documentaries. And then I remember a couple of years ago that they re-aired the Royal Rumble main event for no apparent reason.
That was infamous snow episode, wasn't it?
Yeah, the snow episode. It was the snow episode where everybody was snowed in or something.
They did they not only did it then, but they did it like WWF literally did it years prior. Remember when they aired Hart and Bulldog from In Your House on an episode of Raw?
Yes, I do.
Like, they had done it previously, and there was nothing wrong with that pay-per-view. The cable companies didn't cut out on that. Everyone saw it. They just decided to air it again.
I think it was a situation where their taping sucked.
Yeah.
The show they taped sucks. They wanted to show something else.
Yeah. So I don't get why, like, it worked again and for the Monday Night War, like WCW won that week because of this. They were able to air a pay-per-view match. WCW should have done this more, honestly.
I don't remember anybody saying at the time, oh my God, they aired the pay-per-view main events on television. I will never order another WCW show. I don't remember anybody saying that.
Yeah, I don't know, but I remember there was one edition of Nitro where the first hour was nothing but video packages.
Yeah, they started doing that in like 1999 pretty soon after this. Was I think it was when Kevin Nash had taken over the booking, and Nash just decided he didn't care about the first hour. It was basically what happened there, so they just started showing videos.
It was
miserable. And there were really random videos too. Like there was one week where like Tori Wilson, actually, we mentioned her earlier, and she was not interviewed. I don't think she had been introduced on TV yet at this point, but they like had multiple videos of her of David Flair for some reason.
Yeah.
And then there's another week where Ric Flair got beat up in a field by the NWO.
I love that episode.
And then the best part was like the announcers were supposed to act like they didn't see it. Like it was supposed to be like this weird deal where Flair got beat up in the back of the woods or something. And somehow the announcers are completely unaware. And then Flair randomly shows up at the arena later on and he looks like he's been run through a meat grinder or something. And like Bobby Heenan asks if he's drunk.
I think we mentioned Tori Wilson off air for anybody who is rewinding and like, where did they mention Tori Wilson?
That's right. I wasn't sure. Okay. Yeah. That was during the hour of the off air portion of the show. We're going to do a show on Tori Wilson at some point, too.
I love the leaving Ric Flair for dead in a field video. That was so amazing. I rewatched it a few months ago and it's still the best video ever. I think I posted it on Twitter. With the comment, like, don't ever tell me pro wrestling isn't the best. It's so great. Yeah, he shows up. That was actually the basis for, I don't remember which came first. I think the video game came first before that angle. But the intro to one of their video games, I think it was WCW NWO Revenge, a trucker picks you up and takes you to the arena. Like, this is the exact scenario.
You like, know what?
You're wandering around and a truck and a semi just like pulls up before it hits you. It stops and then you get into the semi and then you're in the Nitro arena all of a sudden.
I think that actually happened before the Flair angle because that was the one with Hollywood and Wolfpack. So I think they basically ripped off their video game.
Yeah, I'm fairly certain it was before this angle, but... I just remember that intro. What a great game that was.
That was one of the best wrestling video games, too.
I love that. I love that angle. Goldberg and Page, they break the record for match rating.
Still broke the company.
We the build up to World War III, Goldberg kept doing nothing. Jericho kept doing his feud, even though it was clearly going nowhere. He didn't care. He just fucking kept going with it. And all of a sudden on some random edition of Nitro, Jericho is still, you know, proclaiming to be 2-0 and everything. Goldberg just charges down the aisle and spears him, and they fight, and then that's the end of the feud.
Very anticlimactic indeed.
Yeah. Poor Chris Jericho. He tried to work up something, but Goldberg just wasn't having it.
And of course, there's the great part of that angle where Jericho is ripping off Goldberg's entrance, which led to the debut of Ralphus as a security guard. And the great instance where they ripped off the This Is Spinal Tap movie, where they walk around backstage forever trying to find the entrance.
That's a fantastic segment. Chris Jericho is so good in so many different roles.
And then Jericho manages to lock himself out of the building. But then you see on the other side, you see a guy opening the door on the other side. Yeah. Like somebody actually thought he wanted to get, you know.
On the go home edition of Nitro prior to World War III, the build up for World War III, by the way, was the winner. It was the 60 ring battle royal, and this was the first pay per view I ever went to. Not the
oh goodness,
not the 1998 edition.
They had a lot of ringside seats for that one, I'm sure.
I went to the 1995 version, Norfolk Scope. That was the one where Randy Savage won. The title was vacant after Halloween Havoc with Hogan.
Oh, yeah, and the Business of the Giant.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the title was vacant and Randy Savage won. That was the Observe This.
Yeah.
I didn't understand that promo at the time.
No, there's no reason for anybody to understand that promo.
I was like 7 years old and I didn't get it.
And the great thing, like they're acting like Randy Savage's injury was a work, but then he was selling it later in the evening during a match. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Like, we worked you, brother. He's not really hurt. And then later on, he's selling me. Okay.
But I love the World War III gimmick, the 60-man battle royal. I thought it was cool. I'm probably the only one. But again,
it's always fun. It's fun to see like what kind of people they drug out of obscurity to fill the rings.
Again, I like wacky gimmick matches. So.
I mean, you talk about the Women's Royal Rumble being filled with random people. The World War III, they had some folks.
Yeah. So the build up for the World War III was the winner faces Goldberg at Starrcade, but no one really talked about it. The build kind of sucked, and the matches were never good. Anyway, on the go home edition of Nitro, Bam Bam Bigelow shows up.
Bam Bam.
He's there to start a fight with Goldberg, and he's portrayed as an outsider in this angle here. And at the end of the night, it's a big brawl between Bigelow and Goldberg, setting up their match at the pay-per-view, which didn't happen. This Bigelow thing, we'll get more into it because it continues.
It continued.
In theory, it was fine. I think they overestimated the value of Bam Bam Bigelow at the end of 1998.
To be fair now, Bam Bam had main evented at WrestleMania before against Lawrence Taylor back in
4 years ago.
But he had kind of fallen off the face of the earth. I mean, he was in ECW for a while, but as much as we love ECW, is never quite the same level as far as viewers as ECW and WWF. So to a lot of people, Bam Bam just kind of came out of nowhere. Like, oh, where's he been?
He main evented the WrestleMania, but he lost. So it's not even like, you know, he lost to a fucking football player. So he's not even portrayed as that big of a threat. And then after that, they did absolutely nothing with him.
Well, he had the cool coat after that, though. He had a jacket.
And again, that was 3-4 years prior to this happening. Yeah, and then he went to ECW and I think they overestimated a lot of the ECW. Like, he had the right look. If you're going to portray this guy as some crazy nut outsider, then
he would look like Bam Bam Bigelow. Yes.
Yeah, it would definitely look like Bam Bam Bigelow. So in that sense, it probably worked. But as far as him being over, it definitely didn't work, as the crowd did not care about Bigelow coming out. So World War III, Goldberg doesn't have a match again, because, you know, God forbid your world champion wrestle on pay-per-views.
That's right.
He saves Rick Steiner from an NWO beatdown after a match, and then during the 60-man battle royal, Bigelow comes out and Goldberg comes out, and they do another pull-apart brawl. So that's your Goldberg angle for World War III.
That was just as exciting as it sounded, Vic.
Kevin Nash wins the battle royal, in case you didn't know. So he earns a shot at Goldberg.
Big Sexy. I got to tell you, the Wolfpack and Big Sexy and all, and they're the cool NWO, right? They're the I know. I was personally was on the side of the Wolfpack with Nash and Sting and Luger, and I had my Wolfpack T-shirt.
Same here.
One of my favorites, the big wolf head. One of my favorite wrestling shirts.
Yeah, I think I have that shirt. I have so many wrestling shirts that they're just packed away in my parents' attic. Yeah, so I had that shirt as well. I was a huge Wolfpack fan. Their music was awesome. Their intro music. It was one of the better entrance themes in wrestling history.
Yeah, I mean, so yeah, going into this, Kevin Nash was as hot as he had been in WCW, certainly. You know, I mean, unless you're really high on Diesel.
November 23rd edition of Nitro, Goldberg beats the Giant in 2 minutes. This was when the Giant was pretty much confirming that he was leaving. But apparently backstage he was wavering because he didn't want to leave the company getting squashed by Goldberg. So he was thinking about re-signing, and he was asking, you know, what he should do and everything. And we obviously know what he ended up doing.
Yeah. Who did he ask?
I don't know. It just says he was just asking people backstage.
Is he asking, like, Ralphus?
I hope so.
what do you think Ralphus was at? something like that, probably.
Well, how do you think I'd do in WWF, Ralphus?
You know.
The November 30th Nitro.
Is Ralphus still alive, by the way?
I do not know. I guess I can Google that right fast. The November 30th edition of Nitro was the contract signing between Goldberg and Nash to set up their Starrcade match. And it was announced that Goldberg would not defend the title until Starrcade. This did not sit well with Bam Bam Bigelow. And Bigelow comes out and wants to fight, and he's kicked out of the arena, and he's outside. There's fans outside, and he's waiting for Goldberg. The crowd is actually pretty hot for this, at least the dozens or so fans outside the arena. And Goldberg ends up coming out at the end of the show, and they brawl in the grass and in the parking lot. Goldberg hits a spear on a hill, and that is a good angle, honestly. It's a great setup for this Goldberg and Bigelow match at Starrcade.
So I was looking up Ralphus.
Yeah, it doesn't say anything about him.
According to Reddit, he lives in Orlando, He has a heart condition apparently, and diabetes, which would make sense because, well, you've seen Ralphus. And let's see what. And he got. I do remember hearing they got a big head after he got put on TV. He got a bit of an ego. Because he's Ralphus and he's a TV star.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
He probably did really well with the ladies, too. Wouldn't you say?
I would assume so. I mean, he had Chris Jericho next to him.
That's right. And then Norman Smiley after that.
Yeah.
So Goldberg and Kevin Nash.
Oh, Goldberg and Bigelow. That's the match that we're doing.
That's how memorable this whole Bigelow thing was. I just keep glossing over it.
The December 7th edition of Nitro. Goldberg is scheduled to face Bigelow, non-title, and Kevin Nash comes out and he says, "You guys aren't fighting tonight. Like, if you think you're fighting, you got another thing coming because I'm interfering."
Because he's the booker.
And Goldberg and Bigelow are going to fight, and Nash comes out and they brawl, and security breaks it up, and the crowd boos and throws trash in the ring. I don't know why the crowd was upset. Kevin Nash told him, like, "You're not going to fight. I'm going to come out and ruin this shit." And he did.
Well, I mean, throwing trash in the ring was a big thing back in this time period. I think, if I remember correctly, it all started back when they formed the NWO.
That is true.
And Hogan turned heel, and they all threw garbage in the ring. And everybody thought that it looked so cool on television that everybody wanted to go to the show and throw garbage.
Yeah.
One of those things where you see it happen one time and everybody else wants to do it. Just like the beach balls. It's like the damn beach balls. Although I think I'd rather have wrestling fans throwing beach balls in the crowd than throwing trash at the ring. That's just me.
The next week on Nitro, they were supposed to meet in a proper triple threat match. So an actually sanctioned triple threat match. A no interference triple threat match, as this was billed as.
That always stops.
What do you think happened, Steve Cook?
I'm just going to take a wild guess and say somebody interfered.
Scott Hall interfered, and it ended in a no contest after about 5 minutes.
Was this when Scott Hall was drunk?
No.
I mean, he was continually drunk throughout most of the ICW, but
this was when they were teasing the Outsiders getting back together and then being... They'd officially gotten back together at this point. But yeah, no interference triple threat match ends when somebody interferes. Yeah, there you go. And then the go-home edition for Starrcade is Goldberg against Scott Hall. How do you think this match ended, Steve Cook?
I'm going to take a wild guess and say Kevin Nash was involved somehow.
Kevin Nash comes out. Goldberg spears Scott Hall. And Nash pulls Hall out of the ring. And Bam Bam Bigelow runs in.
Yeah,
and it's
Bam
a
Bam.
DQ.
Can't forget Bam Bam.
That's your go home for Starrcade.
How come Bam Bam wasn't getting a big title shot?
Oh, that's what I said. It seems like they were setting up a Bigelow and Goldberg match, not a Nash and Goldberg match. This build sucked.
Yeah.
It did not feel like the build up to the biggest match on the biggest show of the year.
You know what else sucked?
What's that?
The match.
Between Goldberg and Nash?
Yeah.
I didn't mind this match. We'll talk about it here in a second.
All right. Yeah. Okay.
This build-up was so bad. And I remember watching or re-watching Starrcade for this review, and the video package, WCW's production and video packages were so far behind WWF at this point.
Yeah.
It was night and day. Like, the intro for Starrcade is just like them with a gradient cloud in front of them, and that's it. Like, there's no substance to these video packages.
Yeah, I mean, a more skeptical person than myself would suggest that part of the reason that this build-up might have been so bad, maybe the person who was booking the shows wanted some proof that Goldberg wasn't as over as people thought.
I guess. But this is so dumb because, Kevin Nash is generally looked at as being a smart guy in wrestling. I think he's honestly brilliant. The man got away with everything. He barely worked. He drew money. Yeah. He got paid like he was the top star in the world.
Yeah.
If you listen,
he got
to
a raise every time somebody else got paid more than he did.
Yeah. If you listen to this guy in shoot interviews, like everything that comes out of his mouth, you know it's bullshit. But he delivers it in such a way where you're like, I kind of believe this guy. he's a very slick talker. And if he knows he's going over Goldberg at Starrcade, why wouldn't he want Goldberg to look super strong?
Well, I mean, your guess is as good as mine. I mean, the justification I was thinking of is that many other folks backstage were like, Goldberg's super strong. He shouldn't be winning. He shouldn't be losing, rather, to anybody. And you know that his buddy Hulk Hogan had been saying, too, hey, I thought I was going over, brother. So Kevin Nash is out here trying to prove these folks out here, this Greenberg, this Goldberg guy, he's just a flash in the pan. He ain't nothing, brother. I mean, it sounds stupid, but I mean, it is wrestling, so.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. But he really couldn't beat Scott Hall on the go home for Starrcade. It had to be a DQ. He couldn't pin Scott fucking Hall.
They'd keep Scott Hall strong, brother.
I guess so.
I mean, Hall already put him over once, remember? Gary took him over back at the Nitro in Atlanta. So we can't have him being hauled too many times.
Starrcade, December 27th, 1998, MCI Center, Washington, D.C. Drew a sellout of about 16,000 fans for about $584,236 at the gate. It was the largest gate for a WCW pay-per-view ever, believe it or not. And it did 460,000 buys, which is the fourth highest in company history, trailing the Starrcade the year before, the Bash at the Beach, and then some other. It was Super Brawl 1999, which I have no recollection of.
Oh. Was that Hogan and Flair, maybe?
It had
to be something with them.
Hogan and Flair and probably be correct because they wrestled a million times. It was Hogan and Flair, actually. Goldberg defeated Bam Bam Bigelow on the show, though, so they finally got – that's probably what drew it. They'd been building this match for months.
There you go. Yeah.
So, yeah, that was the other – those were the three pay-per-views ahead of Starrcade. Two of those make sense. I guess Hogan and Flair could still draw in 1999. Goldberg was billed as 173-0. Go back and count all the matches for yourself.
Yeah. Crowd was
very hot for this match. They worked in some submission spots. Goldberg,
yeah.
Nash does his little choking boot in the corner, and Goldberg powers out of it and takes him down and gets half guard and beats him up and chokes him. And Kevin Nash locks on an arm bar, and Goldberg powers out of that, and he locks on a heel hook. And then
I've been watching that UFC, man.
Yeah. And then Goldberg takes over, tosses Nash around, looks really impressive. Nash bumps well for him, all things considered. Disco Inferno runs in. If you're wondering why the fuck he ran in, it's because this was when he was trying to prove himself that he was a member of the Wolfpack. And he said, yeah, Kev says I'm in. So he runs in and he gets speared. Bigelow runs in. He gets tossed. No, this match is no DQ, I guess. This is a no interference match that actually doesn't end when there's interference. And Goldberg's setting up for the spear. Scott Hall hits him with the taser, cattle prod, stun gun, Goldberg killer.
Security guard Scott Hall.
Yeah, whatever you want to call it.
He's a security guard. What kind of security guard is tasing people, man? Come on.
He tases Goldberg. Goldberg, his body convulses, and Nash picks him up. He hits the jackknife, pins him. 173-1.
That's one of those tasers, the police shoes. It's like a stun gun. That was Scott Hall.
That was Scott Hall. You could hear it clicking. It was like a cattle prod or a stun gun.
Kevin Nash never saw that.
And he jabbed it in the midsection of Goldberg.
Oh, no.
Wait a minute.
Jackknife
powerbomb.
Could this be it? 1, 2, 3.
The streak is over. And we have a new world champion.
The streak is over. 173-1. And a new world champion. Kevin Nash is crowned world's heavyweight champion.
And the crowd popped big for this pinfall here. The crowd was split the whole time, but they were split on who sucked more because the chants were Goldberg sucks and Nash sucks.
It's shades of later period WWE, I suppose.
Yeah, as Roman and Cena all over again.
Some similarities there, I suppose, but you know how it is whenever guys get on big winning streaks. And you see in sports, too, when teams go on big winning streaks, have long periods of success, like Goldberg was having there, there are going to be a lot of fans out there that want to see the big guy lose. You even saw it like towards the end of the Undertaker WrestleMania streak. A lot of people, there are people out there who wanted to see Undertaker lose. And Goldberg was at that point where he, you know, won 173 matches or however many he won. It was a lot. He won a bunch of matches in a row. He hadn't lost since he entered the company. So there was a sizable portion of the audience that did not mind seeing the guy lose. So, and I hate to go against conventional wisdom again, a lot of people, I know Bobby Heenan used to say that Goldberg losing was the end of the company, and I would say not necessarily. Not necessarily. And by itself, Goldberg losing wasn't the worst thing in the world. Now, how they followed it up. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I don't think this was the end of the company. Goldberg losing. Goldberg, he was cold at this point. And a lot of that had to do with the overall booking. I mean, let's look
Bam
back.
Bam Bigelow endlessly and not really doing anything?
Yeah, I mean, let's look back at this now, because that wraps up the arc here. The streak is over. For those wondering what the follow-up was, the next night on Nitro, Goldberg did not appear. Kevin Nash came out and he said, you know, Scott Hall meant well, but, you know, he there's an asterisk next to that one in your streak. So the next Monday, which was back in the Georgia Dome, mind you,
yeah,
we're gonna do the rematch, the Goldberg and Nash rematch, and I'm sure everyone knows this. We could do a whole arc on
that
that show, kind of like we did with Survivor Series 98. We could do a whole arc on that, but yeah. The finger poke of doom was the end of this, essentially. But the streak is over, and you look back, everything up to the title win was good. Like, yeah. The feud with Raven, you know, he beat guys that you'd heard of, and he wins the U.S. title, and he defends the title against still known guys. I mean, Conan, Hennig, NWO guys, they plant the seeds of that NWO feud right there after he wins the US title. The beating Hogan, Hall and Hogan on Nitro, like all of that made sense. I mean, you can argue about giving it away on Nitro, but it worked for what they wanted to accomplish. Like, it was the biggest audience up to that point in history. It was in front of the fucking Georgia Dome, a WrestleMania venue. Like, everything worked up to his title win, and everything from the title win to the title loss at Starrcade, outside of the Page match, none of it worked.
Yeah, I mean, once you got the title, it seemed like they pretty much were like, okay, we're done. We're done here. Let's move on. And they got wrapped up in other things. Like, they got wrapped up in Hogan's feud. So the celebrity stuff with Rodman, Malone, Jay Leno. They're really infatuated with all that business up on top. You had, and then you brought in the Ultimate Warrior, the feud with Hogan. And it was Hogan, Hogan, Hogan there. And Goldberg just kind of, he's the champion. He's there. He's over there. He's beating up Kurt Hennig or whatever. It is what it is. He's winning Battle Royals. It's just kind of a thing. Once Goldberg won the title, they just like, we got our things to do. We got our stuff to worry about. We got Hulk to worry about. And, you know, you had Nash to worry about, too, because Nash got the book around that time period. And Nash was over. Let's not gloss over that. The guy was over with the fans. I was fine with him in that spot at Starrcade, but it just looks really bad when you're the booker and you're booking yourself to beat Goldberg and be the one in the 173-1. It just looks bad.
The streak ending is fine because Goldberg was cold at this point. Like, I don't know how much more mileage you could have gotten out of it, but I agree
with
you.
Not much at that point.
No. Yeah, but I agree that it looks bad when you're the booker and you're booking yourself to put this guy over. It's very Triple H-ish. If that's a word.
Triple H learned from the master, didn't he?
That's true. but it's very much like that of, all right, we know why you're the champion. Like, you did this yourself. You're booking yourself to make yourself look strong. And it just feels very cheap in that regard. And that's pretty much what happened here. The problem is, again, in fairness to Nash, he was over.
Yeah.
I mean, who else is going to end the streak at this point?
Well, I think they promised Hogan, yeah, which not an ideal answer either, but
I think your only options are, I mean, Hogan could still draw. Hogan was smart enough to take himself off of television at this point. He went away after the Warrior match.
He retired and he's going to run for president.
That's right. So he went away. He took himself off of television here. And when he came back, you know, it's always a big deal when Hogan's gone for a little while and he comes back. So he was smart to go away for a bit. And I think when he came back, it was clearly a big moment. I think he could have ended the streak, honestly, and gotten like a big babyface reaction because of it. Because Goldberg, the fans had started to turn on Goldberg at this point, and you could have almost done a double turn out of it. But who else is there? Like Sting is always going to be over, but
he wasn't quite as hot at that point.
No,
I mean the whole Wolfpack business kind of took the shine off a little bit. They brought in Bret Hart, but
Bret Hart.
We didn't even mention Bret Hart during his whole podcast, by the way, which tells you what Bret Hart was doing.
Yeah.
Not much.
I legitimately, when researching for this podcast, like I knew it was 98 and I know the Screwjobs in 97. So I know Bret Hart is in the company.
Yeah.
And then when I saw Bret Hart's
name,
when I saw his name pop up when in doing research, I'm just like, wait, Bret Hart was there? Like what? I have no recollection of any
the
of
one
this.
Time- The one time he pops up is actually that Goldberg Sting match that's in the fracas afterwards with Hogan beating him down, and Bret Hart comes down and makes a save for Sting because Sting and Bret were doing a feud slash thing at that point.
I think he pops up. He was feuding with DDP at various points during this as well, and I think Goldberg makes a save for Paige or something, but.
I remember that Bret Sting feud was one I was looking forward to, especially at that time as a kid. I was a big fan of both those guys, and that didn't live up to my expectations at all.
No, not at all. So, like, they had killed Bret by this point. I don't think he could have
ended not at that it. Point. Now, 99, he got a little hotter in 99. He's finally hitting his stride in WCW right when Goldberg kicked his head off, actually.
Yeah. You know, Flair had just returned. I think they could have gotten some mileage out of a Flair and Goldberg program.
I'm not sure if you, I'm not sure if you put Flair over him or not. But
No. I don't think you put Flair over him. But I do think that's a program that
something they could have done instead of nothing.
Yeah, I mean, he returned on the Nitro after Fall Brawl, like. I guess you couldn't do it. You could have done that as a program.
Doing the Bischoff thing. Yeah.
Yeah, like that's true. I guess if you wanted to extend the streak, past Starrcade, like he beats Nash or Nash doesn't win the Battle Royal, somebody else wins and Goldberg beats him at Starrcade. You can do Goldberg and Flair heading into the January pay-per-view or the February pay-per-view and extend that.
I'm trying to think if Flair and Goldberg ever really had a feud, an extended one. There was a brief thing, because I remember because I went to a Nitro in March 99, where the main event was Hogan and Nash teaming against Flair and Goldberg. And Flair walked out in Goldberg in that match. And I think they did something after that, but it didn't not a whole lot, I don't think.
They were supposed to wrestle a lot of house shows around this time. Reading the old Observers, it's headlined for a little bit, or it's advertised for a little bit, and then they just end up dropping even the house show matches. So I think it seems like they had some type of plans to do something with them. They just didn't do it.
Didn't happen.
Yeah. Early 99 WCW, Flair comes back and he's a major babyface, and then all of a sudden he's the biggest fucking heel in the company.
It was like a couple weeks after that beating in the field where they did the double turn. I think it might have been that Super Brawl.
Yeah, that was early 99 WCW was just so bad with all the turns and stuff. DDP just randomly turns heel for no reason, like after he wins the title. That company was a mess.
They had a lot of creative changes. Guys getting a book a different week. It was a mess. That's the Nitro I went to. I remember that. I remember it being really good. And I remember being surprised it was really good. Because at that point, I was not looking forward to that show. Because at that point, Nitro had been really bad. That was that time period where you had the random videos in the first hour and all that shit. But for whatever reason, that night in Cincinnati, they actually put on a really good show. You had like Rey Mysterio and Kidman. You had Booker T versus Jericho. You met the main event I mentioned. There's just a lot of really good stuff for a 1999 Nitro.
All right. The streak ends at Starrcade. And it felt like they really just dropped the ball after the title win. They could have, you know, at this time, Goldberg got a lot of comparisons with Steve Austin, and, you know, Jim Ross was taking cheap shots on Raw, and Tony Schiavone was trying to fire back. They were up against each other a lot in the media. You know, going through the old Observers, they were on the cover of Rolling Stone competing against each other. So a lot of comparisons between the two, and it just really feel like they missed the boat after they put the title on them.
Pretty much. Now, were you I'll ask you, were you an Austin guy or a Goldberg? Did you have a preference between Austin and Goldberg? I'll tell you, I was an Austin guy.
I was much bigger on Austin. I actually met Goldberg, and I had a Goldberg figure. It was at some golf event in North Carolina, and he signed my figure, and I'm sure it's somewhere. But he was nice guy and everything when I met him, but I was more of an Austin fan. I liked the character more, and I just liked his matches more. I think even as a younger kid, like, I understood the appeal of Goldberg, and I understood that they kind of killed that appeal by not having him wrestle on pay-per-view a lot.
Pretty much, yeah. I guess the comparisons pretty much came down to the bald head and the goatee, let's be honest. And the black tights, they had similar looks. I mean, Goldberg looked like Steve Austin on steroids, let's be honest.
That's really where it starts and ends. Like, their wrestling style was completely different.
Yeah.
Their characters were different. Their promos were different. I mean, Austin actually cut long promos. And like, everything else was different, but they were compared because of bald head and goatee.
They all look alike.
So that is the streak. Any final thoughts on Goldberg and the streak and what happened here, Cook?
The streak was, it's a glorious time in WCW, let's be honest. It's one of the times where, up until a certain point, they got it right. And people have tried to do it again. We've seen multiple wrestlers have streaks. Hell, Asuka has a long streak right now, but there hasn't been one like Goldberg's. And I don't think there will be.
It's the only, it's pretty much universally recognized as, like, the only thing they got right after the, you know, their peak period.
The NWO and Goldberg, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah. They peaked with the NWO, and they could really do no wrong. Like, the Cruiserweight division was hot around that time. You know, Hogan, Hall, Nash, Sting, Luger, I mean, the Sting stuff, especially that whole year build, like, all of that was so hot at the time. And they did really well with a lot of it. I mean, you can say NWO got overcrowded, but the Sting stuff was fantastic. But really, after Sting, they didn't do much of anything good. Like, the follow-up to the Sting stuff was bad. Swapping the title between Sting and Hogan and everything, like, none of that really worked. But Goldberg came along, and he was really the only new star they created. Like, everyone else was a WWE rehash or an established WCW guy.
Pretty much. He was their one new guy that came up through the power plants and kicked ass, took names. Like I said, just one of those periods in wrestling history where you look back and, like, you know, that was a pretty good time. Goldberg was a pretty good time. Good to see him go in the Hall of Fame. Not sure I want to see him back in the ring again, but hey, you never know.
I liked his last WWE run. They actually booked him like Goldberg. Quick matches. The Lesnar match was way better than it probably had any right to be. It was smoke and mirrors.
They did right the second time around. The first time around was,
The first Goldberg WWF run was, I guess it was WWE at that point, but God, that was just dreadful. He died when Goldust put the wig on him. Like, that was the end of that character. The second run last year was good, I thought. I don't need to see him back in the ring again either. It seemed like he just came back for his kid. His kid saw him wrestle. Like, that should be the end of it.
So if he has another kid.
Yeah. Good on him for going in the Hall of Fame. It's a meaningless Hall of Fame. I think we can all agree on that. But, you know, he's going to get his moment. He's going to get his speech. I'm sure he'll say some good things and whatnot. And the streak, it definitely was a time in wrestling history that it's not going to be replicated.
Nope.
No matter how much you try. Yeah.
Yep. Poor Ryback.
Poor Ryback, indeed. Wrestling Kalisto on pre-shows. Shit, at least he got on the show. Goldberg didn't even get on half these shows when he was champion.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, if they had a two-hour kickoff show back in the day, he would have.
Maybe.
By Cracky.
All right, folks, that's going to wrap it up for us. We will be back in 2 weeks with a new arc. I don't know when we're going to do it, but at some point prior to WrestleMania, we will do Daniel Bryan's journey to WrestleMania 30, starting at the... I think we're going to start that one at SummerSlam when he beats Cena for the title all the way up to WrestleMania 30. So you have that to look forward to. The next time the arc we will do is pretty unknown at this time. We don't decide these things.
I think we're doing Torrey Wilson.
I think we would love to do Torrey Wilson, but I don't think either of us has a real shot.
We could do the Al Wilson storyline. That is a good piece of business.
Oh, my God. Don't think we're going to do that. But stranger things have happened on this show, I guess. We'll figure something out. We'll conversate in the next couple of days and figure it out. But until then, you can follow Steve Cook on Twitter at SteveCook84. He will be tweeting a lot of hockey in the next couple of months, I'm sure, as we get ready for the playoffs. What are you working on for
lots of games?
411 or Pred Lines or the Chair Shot, Cook?
We got all kinds of columns right now at thechairshot.com. We did the top five, you know what it said? I can't remember what the hell I did. Top five underdog champions. That's right. In honor of the Philadelphia Eagles upsetting the Patriots. Very topical. So we did that. Got something else coming out there soon on Chair Shot. Pred Lines, we do some game recapping stuff there. That's always a good time. 411 Mania, I'm working on a column about the Women's Elimination Chamber match at, it's at Elimination Chamber. How about that? So, and that should be up. That'll be up by the time this gets posted, probably. So I'll have like 15 articles up because I write a lot of things.
There you go. I'm at Jeremy Lambert 88. Don't follow me on Twitter unless you want my terrible basketball takes where I think my
team
is always going to lose. The most pessimistic sports fan you're going to find. Check out thechairshot.com. Always great content, whether audio or written form.
Use your head.
That's right. And yeah, we'll be back in 2 weeks. Thanks everybody for listening.